Bad Segundo, may you not rest so long as I live on. I killed you. Haunt me then. Haunt your murderer. I know that the ghosts of radio show hosts have wandered the earth. Be with me always. Take any form. Drive me mad. Only do not leave me in this dark alone where I cannot find you. I cannot live without my life. I cannot die without my soul.
Okay, so I am here with Andrea Arnold, who is most recently the director of Wuthering Heights, not the author. Andrea, how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you.
So there's one really intriguing quality about your films that I have observed. Your characters are often defined by how they observe things. Of course, the obvious explicit example is Red Room, because we have closed circuit cameras in there. But we do see that in Wuthering Heights quite a bit, often through slats, often through little cracks. And I'm wondering, why are you so interested in this idea of defining characters by how they look at things? Is this a way to kind of offer a vicarious experience to the viewer? Do you feel that looking at things or what people decide to see is of greater import or greater revelation than, say, how they perform, how they act?
Well, I don't know the answer to that question, really, because I think when I'm writing, I don't really think that lucidly about what I'm writing and how I'm writing it. And now you've just said that to me, I realise actually what you've just said is true.
Yes.
But actually, if you'd asked me to sort of define how I do things, I would never have said that I'm doing that. But now you've just told me, I realise you're right. And I think that I write quite instinctively, and for some reason I seem to be doing that, like always. I'm always picking... I've only ever done one film where I told it from two people's point of view, where I switched from one person to another. Most of the films I've done so far have been telling it from one person's point of view. And for some reason, that feels like the right thing to do to me. It's like I feel able to get inside one person's head. I find it more difficult to get into lots of people's heads. So maybe just because I'm telling the story from that person's point of view and I'm going along with them and thinking about how they're thinking and I'm trying to get inside their head. So I think that maybe... by looking at the world from their point of view, I'm trying to get inside their head and work out how they're feeling.
Yeah.
So does that explain?
It absolutely makes sense. I mean, it makes me actually ask, you know, at what point do you decide, oh, the camera must see what they're seeing? It seems to me that this would be a fairly late process in the planning. Is that safe to say? I mean, when do you think about this? Do you think about this during the act of writing a script or anything?
I do think about it when I'm writing, because I'm thinking constantly about what they're looking at and what they're doing and what they're feeling. And I think that a lot of what ends up in the film is things that I've put on the page.
Yeah.
I mean, even in Wuthering Heights, you know, people say to me, was that in the script? And actually, you know, the moths, you know, they were in the script. The moths are in the script, you know. The beetle wasn't in the script, but the moths are.
what do you do to get an insect wrangler, by the way? I was curious about that. How do you find the moth expert in among the moors?
Well,
those
moths actually were proper Yorkshire moths.
Oh, they were?
Yeah,
okay.
They were proper, like... The moths made me cry, actually, because we got moths from a man who dealt in Yorkshire moths. A Yorkshire moth expert, I guess.
A specialist
in Yorkshire moths.
There are moth specialists, I did not know.
Yeah,
How do you get a moth to behave on camera?
Well... Yeah,
I mean, you know, they say the thing about
moths don't take direction.
Animals.
Not really. Yeah, no, exactly. They don't. You have to let them be themselves. but he gave us these moths, which were in little sort of capsules. And when we let them out, some of them died, and it actually made me cry. I guess they do die. I mean, moths don't last very long like butterflies, do they?
But don't we all, right?
No, yes.
Well, I mean, you know, that's interesting that you would feel such sympathy for the moths when this film also depicts a lot of sheep and a lot of rabbits simulated, I would suspect. I don't think this was a Boonwell Land Without Bread situation on your part. But, I mean, there is quite a lot of animal violence, and I'm wondering, you know, what you also did to get that looking as real as it did, and why you felt compelled to include this as a representative rough element of this great frontier of the 19th century.
Well, I guess it was, dealing with animals and having animals on the farm living and dying would be part of life, and it's part of our life now, only it's a hidden part of our lives. In fact, it's a far worse thing now in life because it's all behind doors and we all pretend it doesn't happen. But you know, and animals are factory farmed in far worse ways. They're not roaming free and then getting slaughtered at the end of their lives. They're living in sheds and having pretty closed down lives. So, you know, it happens all the time now and then. And I just wanted to represent that accurately. We have managed to obviously do a good job, because I get people say, I think at Sundance, somebody came up to me after and said, oh, I feel so sorry for that sheep, you know. And I said, why? And he said, you killed the sheep. And I said, no, we didn't kill the sheep.
And he's no doubt saying this after having a lamb chop dinner, right?
No. Well, exactly. Yeah. But I mean, we didn't kill the sheep. And in actual fact, I was so worried about that sheep when we did that scene. I was more worried about that sheep than anyone. I mean, we had a vet there and we had the farmer there who owned the sheep. But that sheep, I have to tell you, was the most amazing sheep.
Oh, yeah? We couldn't. Amazing?
He was so amazing, that sheep, because he was so calm. He wasn't frightened. And he did this thing in the film. You'll see he's trembling. It looks like you've done something really bad to him.
Yeah.
He just started doing that. It was like he knew that he needed to look.
Really?
I really don't know. Quite.
Unrehearsed. Improvisational sheep. Wow.
And it trotted off and went. And I kept saying to the farmer and the vet, "Is sure the sheep's all right?" And he goes, "The sheep's fine." And actually, he went off, trotted back to the herd, no problem. That sheep was
no ague or anything.
No what?
No ague or anything.
No what?
No, like no tremors or anything like that. No dizziness.
No. It seemed completely fine.
And there even are method acting sheep.
Well, he was that sheep was just we couldn't have picked a better sheep. Even when we were carrying it, it was just so calm. It didn't seem frightened. It seemed completely fine. But of course, we didn't harm the sheep. In fact, I was very, very concerned about that sheep and made sure he was completely fine. But no, we didn't harm anything. I mean, we make it look bad, but of course, no.
Yeah.
I'm a vegetarian and animal sure. complete, you know.
Well, we talked about moths dying. I mean, is there anything equivalent to the SPCA in the British Isles that would actually, that you'd have to get the endorsement from him?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. No, I didn't see any endorsement on the film or anything like that.
Yeah, we had animal handlers there all the time. Okay. Oh, yeah.
You don't need to have the designated stamp on the credits like we do here.
We have the thing that, you know, no animals were harmed. Yeah. I mean, that's what you have that's what you have to have, and you have to have people who are there who endorse that and who sign something to say that.
Yeah.
So we had all that. We had everything that you're supposed to have.
What about, so you wanted to include these animals dying on film, simulated, of course, because in the name of historical accuracy, I'm wondering what research you did to sort of know how people lived during that time. I know that there were depilatory restrictions in place, and I'm curious, you know, what did you do to sort of know that this is actually true? Or was this largely instinctive? Was this largely trusting your gut? Was this largely saying, okay, well, if we don't have television, radios, and smartphones, then we're just living on a farm, people are just going to live like this?
Partly imagining what it would be like to live on a farm. Partly I spoke to farmers, and I talked to some of the farmers up in Yorkshire about how things would have been, and they had, a lot of the people up in that area have been up there for generations and had actually a lot of information. So I did, you know, I went down to a place where people dealt with animals and spoke to a lot of the farmers down there and talked to people. So I did sort of partly talk to people and partly imagination, partly what they were telling me. Uh-huh. For example, you know, the way they put their foot on the sheep and stuff like that, that was all told to me, the way they did that. Yeah. You know, I researched all those things about how they would handle the sheep and stuff like that, so how they would carry it and...
Do you feel that imagining what a situation is like is going to carry more truth on cinema than, say, sticking with the hard facts or the hard details or going by the letter of what the Yorkshire farmers tell you?
I mean, I think I'm somebody who, if I hear something and I believe it to be the truth and they've told me something truthful, I will try and honour that as best I can. And I incorporate that into what I'm doing. So if they've told me something that I, you know, and... I've heard it a couple of times from the right kind of people, then I think I would do my utmost to make sure that I represent that as accurately as they've told me. I think I'm somebody who does actually care about those things.
Yeah.
And doesn't want to, you know, I mean, when I'm talking about using my imagination, I'm talking about using my imagination more to do with the emotion or to do with the way people are interacting with each other. I'm not talking to do about sort of practical facts. If I hear something is done a certain way.
Yeah.
Also, I have a designer that I work with, and she's very like that too.
Uh-huh.
And even the house which we restored, because it was quite run down.
Oh, interesting.
We restored it using all the traditional methods. And so all the people that worked on the house used old skills in order to restore it. We didn't like put plastic up that looks like a thatch roof. We put proper thatch up.
Yeah.
We restored the walls in the plaster they would have used.
Yeah.
We used the right kind of wood.
The stone wall on the outside, was that touched? touched up or built by the cast, perhaps?
Stone walls were all mostly there. The dry stone walls has been something, you know, that's all over Yorkshire.
Yeah.
So all the people working on the house before we started filming there, they were all using old skills, which they all really, really enjoyed.
Uh-huh.
And there was a lot of love went into the building of that house because people were not just pretending, they were making it look... They rebuilt it using proper traditional skills and using proper materials, because I'm very I don't want any plastic around, and you can obviously get plastic walls that look like the real thing, but that's not how I like to do things. I like it to feel real.
Huh.
So that's something that we worked very hard on, and the designer knows I like that, and she worked with all the builders to make sure that was. The way it happened.
If you have a ban on plastic, was it very difficult to find the real old materials that humanity used to use with you and your desire to find?
No, they didn't. Not as far as I know.
Yeah.
That kept from you?
Yeah, no. Well, I'm sure if they did have plastic somewhere, they would have hidden it from me because.
Andrea again is having me go 100 miles to get that piece of wood.
No, they know. I almost get upset if I see something that doesn't feel real.
Yeah.
The thing is, Helen, who's the designer, I mean, I trust her completely, and she also likes that too. So, you know, she would have worked with all the builders. And I remember she said to me that people were really enjoying it because they were using old skills, building in the ways that people would have built that house, and using the real materials. And everyone, rather than just faking it, they were doing it for real. And she said there was a lot of love that went into the building of that house because people were doing it in that way.
Being upset when something isn't real, I'm curious, did you sometimes, you're about to set up a shot, did you see like one detail that wasn't real enough that you had to actually touch
like
up?
Like the Ramblers on the Pennine Way.
Uh-huh.
We had I joked about having a Rambler Wrangler with a shotgun to people in orange jackets at the back of the hill. Yeah, no. We were in such a remote place, there wasn't really anything that... much from the modern day there. There was a road very, very far off that occasionally a car would come down, but we were in such a remote place, there was nothing there. There were no telephone wires not even on a plane path, so we didn't get planes. So I think we did start to imagine we were in some, sort of in the past on some level.
Yeah.
And even people's mobile phones didn't work. Nobody could get a signal. So we were completely uncontactable.
Wow.
We were just sort of, you know...
How far away were you from civilization in case you had to get a bite to eat or a room to stay in?
Well, we were all living in the local village, and I don't think the village will ever forget it, to be honest.
You pissed them off?
No, we got on really well with them, but we had some parties which they joined in on,
uh-huh.
which were quite fun. But we were all mostly staying in a village that was probably about an hour away. And we had a sort of base down in the farmer's field, and we would all, in order to get up to that house, we would have to come in a four-wheel drive about 20 minutes up a dirt track. So we were really far away, and nobody did have any signals. I mean, you couldn't get, and people are not used to that anymore, you know, there's a lot of frustration, but you get used to it, you know, you just switch your phone off and you're not contactable, and that's that.
Yeah. You just go through the obligatory withdrawal period. You throw them in the hole and everything's okay. actually, I wanted to ask you, because your two previous films are really defined by having these tall housing blocks where we often look down. Elevation is a huge factor in the way that these people live in both Red Room and Fish Tank. And in this... Well, we do have the scene in the moors, the horse ride up near the end, but with this, it's fairly flat by comparison, which is actually ironic in light of the fact that, well, Wuthering Heights is defined by the moors. So my question to you is, you know, how did you adjust your visual style when you knew that everything was essentially like, you know, at this kind of flat one-story level?
I mean, I try and work with wherever we are and I don't try and sort of put the camera in any artificial place.
Yeah.
So if I'm filming in a place where there's a lot of flats, then obviously we can put the camera in you know, high up, and we can put it in different places, you know, in relation to that space. So the moors was a completely different space, and I would not try and I think there is only one place where you see the camera high up at the end.
Yeah.
And we had to use something artificial in order to do that, and that feels wrong to me. Because I feel like almost you shouldn't be putting the camera in a place that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
No, it totally does. So the camera, if you're going to elevate it, it has to actually be at a place where a human person could occupy.
Yeah, you know, if I'm looking out here now, I can see, you know, lots of high-rise flats, and if I'm filming that, I would feel fine about putting the camera in any of those places that you could see, and it would be like a genuine place. So when we're on the moors, I never want to use cranes or I think we even used a dolly on this, and I felt really weird using it because it felt strange. I don't like the movement of it really. I just adjust to wherever we are. I just think, well, that's the space, that's how it is. To be honest, even getting a wide shot was a sort of pain in the neck because we'd have to walk all the camera boxes and everyone would have to carry them because we couldn't have any vehicles on that land.
Wow.
So if I wanted to do a wide shot of the house, that would mean all of us with camera boxes on our heads walking up the moors, which would take about an hour to get to that place. So after a while, he started giving up wide shots because it was just no time to walk, you know, those boxes everywhere. And if you were very unlucky, you got the lens box, which was really heavy.
Oh, wow.
So,
I actually also, while we're on the subject of camera placement, I wanted to ask about this interesting juxtaposition of handheld camera work and Steadicam. You know, especially in Fish Tank, it sort of reminds me of what Lindsay Anderson did in IF, where he used color in black and white. But what people don't realize is he basically just used the cheapest stock available to go ahead and get that look. I was wondering if it was similar for you, your use of the Steadicam in all of your films or in various parts. I mean, is it really dictated by...
We haven't got any Steadicam anywhere.
Not in this one. You have the dolly.
We have a dolly on a very few occasions.
Yeah.
Was there
no Steadicam in
Steadicam at all.
Fish Tank?
I don't like Steadicam. No Steadicam.
Really? That was just a dolly? Okay.
That's just Robbie.
Oh, wow.
Robbie, who's got very sturdy hands.
Oh, okay.
No, we didn't even have any jibs or any...
Really? No gimbals?
It's just Robbie.
Wow.
It's just Robbie, my cameraman, Robbie Ryan, who's an amazing man.
There are a lot of people I know who have said that Fish Tank has all this great Steadicam.
No.
Yeah, wow.
No Steadicam whatsoever. It's just Robbie. Robbie is the Steadicam.
Huh.
He's just holding the camera.
Do you think that human balance is more authentic looking?
I don't like Steadicam. I feel the Steadicam movement makes me feel a bit sick.
Uh-huh.
Because I think it goes against natural movement. And Robbie is just... Robbie holds the camera like an extension of himself.
Yeah.
And the very first thing I ever did with Robbie was a film... I did a short film called Wasp.
Yes.
And the very first shot I did with him, I wanted, in my mind, because I'm not thinking about how things are difficult, I'm thinking about what I see, and then I ask him. And the very first thing I said to him was, well, I imagine her, she's running down the steps with the baby in her arms and the kids, and we're on her face. And she's running down the block of flats. So that's what I imagine. But then I realize what that means for Robbie is he's got to run backwards down, you know, flights of steps.
Yes.
With the camera in his hand. He was like, no problem. And the first ever shot I did with him, he was running backwards down a block of flats. I mean, four or five flights running backwards with the camera. And I thought, he's my kind of man. I just loved him from that moment. I just thought, you know, I say to him, I imagine a shot as one continuous shot, you know, in Fish Tank, when Michael Fassbender leaves and he leaves the flat, and I wanted her to be running out and running after him without there be any pause, no cut, nothing. And Robbie just goes, okay, and he runs after her with a 35mm camera on his shoulder, and he runs, you know, out the door, through the doors, down the, you know, down the stairs, down the, you know, after the car. He'll do it six times.
So what provoked?
And then he'll shout at me afterwards. But
so if you are committed to this real organic camera work, you know, why did you use the dolly then in Wuthering Heights? Why was it necessary?
Well, we had a lovely grip called Sam,
uh-huh.
And Sam didn't have much to do. And I think Robbie felt a bit sorry for him now and again, and gave him said, "Could you just put up some dolly up there? It would take him all morning." And then I would not like it.
So, really?
Well. I said to him,
"What about poor Sam?"
No, Sam is lovely. I love Sam. But what happened basically was, I think we had very, very rough terrain, and Robbie said to me, "Look, I may not be able to always keep it smooth on this kind of terrain, so we might need the dolly." And I went, "Okay," even though I hate dollies, I went, "Okay, I'll give it a go." But every time we got the dolly, I would be like, no, I don't like it. I don't like it. So I just was, I was experimenting with the dolly. Because he told me about the rough terrain. I thought, well, maybe he's right. You know, it's going to be a bit rough. He can't keep running on this, on the moor with the tufts of grass and the holes and the mole holes and the things you can fall down. So maybe having some track is a good thing to do. But that, that smooth movement on that tough terrain doesn't feel right to me. So so even though we experimented and tried, there are a couple of dolly shots. There are not many. I think if I went through and looked at how many end up in the film, there's maybe maybe a couple.
Yes.
But we did more than that, but I didn't like them. I didn't like it. And I knew, the thing is, I knew I didn't really like it, but I didn't want to, I didn't want Robbie to fall down a molehole. Mm-hmm. So.
We strayed quite a bit from your source material, Emily Brontë, and I wanted to actually ask you about poor Emily here. Most people who read Wuthering Heights do so when they're very young. I presume this is the case with you.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, you know, when you were actually looking at how to adapt this, what benefit the hindsight of life experience offered you? I mean, did you see certain things with new eyes? Is this why the immortal line, fuck you, all you cunts, which I don't remember reading in the original book, somehow made its way in here? I liked the sheer iconoclasm of that line, but it's safe to say this is a fairly liberating adaptation, very loose. So, you know, and yet at the same time, the second half seems to be more closer to the book. And so, yeah. So I'm wondering, you know, how such an adaptation came into place, and what respect do you owe Emily Brontë?
Well, I've got a lot of respect for Emily Brontë. My respect for Emily Brontë just grew and grew during the process and during the journey as I got to know her more and think about her more and think about what she was really writing about. And the more I got to know, the more respect I have for her. I really, really did. I think the language came out of me researching and finding out that people spoke in a very ballsy way then. It was pre-Victorian.
Yeah.
So people were very, apparently very, swore a lot. And I love that. I thought that's great. And also, I'm casting a lot of non-actors.
Yeah.
And putting the sort of the language from the book into their mouths would be very artificial.
Yeah.
Also, I think people... I took license with a bit that people write... they don't write like they speak. You know, when you're writing something, you do your... You know, you make it sound sort of fancy and posh, don't you? But actually, you don't speak like that. So so I also didn't... wasn't trying to be like... adapt it in a sort of faithful, in a sort of I was trying to get the essence of it, which means I think I can take a bit of artistic license to try and capture the essence, and that means really allowing yourself to be a bit more free rather than trying to stick exactly with the book. I mean, if I was going to be faithful, I would have done the second half of the book. Someone asked me yesterday, is there something you miss, you know, you wish you could have included? I said, yeah, the second half of the book.
Yeah.
You know.
But it's not a book that could actually easily be crammed into a 2-hour film. I mean, it's that's why we have these long-ass adaptions.
Yeah. You know? I think we could get all, you know, it would be a torture chamber, wouldn't it, to be 10 hours of it? It would be just too much.
Yeah. So, I mean, going back to the initial question I had, I was curious, like, you know, what did you see revisiting Wuthering Heights, I guess, after a period of, like, what, you know, a couple decades or something. You know, what did Wuthering Heights say to you that it didn't say to you during your first read? I was curious.
Well, I think, I mean, as I said before, it was a bit of a journey, and I started off with one thought, because when it first landed in my email box, would I be interested? I immediately thought of Heathcliff, because I remember thinking Heathcliff is this strange, sort of quite revengeful, dark character, but he has this really abused childhood where people are really horrible to him.
Yeah.
So, well, lo and behold, how does someone turn out if you treat them that way? So I thought, well, I want to tell his story. So that was my first thought. But then as I went on the journey and I read the book more and I started really looking at it, I started to think all kinds of things about where it was coming from. And, I mean, obviously it's a book that kind of people find incomprehensible, and it's a very uncomfortable, troubling book on some level. But I started to think that it was really everybody in the book was Emily, and that Emily was really... I started to think a lot about Emily, and I think really now... You know what I'd do now is I'd cast a woman as Heathcliff.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd do that now. If I was going to do it again now, I'd have made Heathcliff a woman.
Yeah. Why do you think... I got to go, but last question. Why do you think most adaptations of literary classics end up being so stodgy or... play it safe? Why do you think that is? Do you think there's just too much reverence attached? Or?
I don't know. I mean, I do sometimes, like people say, oh, you used handheld, that people don't do that in period films. I think, why not?
Yeah.
It's like there's been an established... I mean, I wasn't being reactionary by doing something the way I did it. I just tried to make the film in the only way I knew how.
Yeah.
And that, you know, meant following certain things I'd done already. But I think those films are made with a sort of reverence. I don't know why. I don't know why, but they are, and we've all got used to that being a sort of form or a style.
There should be a statute of limitations. Okay, guys, it's been like 50 years. We can go ahead and fuck shit up.
We can say cunt.
Okay. That's a good way to end this. Andrea, thanks so much. It was a pleasure.
Pleasure.
All right.